From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the new book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. And we're coming to you from the Council on Foreign Relations headquarters in Washington, D.C. Richard Haass previously served as senior Middle East advisor to President George H.W. Bush and as the director of policy planning staff under Secretary of State Colin Powell. Haass is the recipient of the Presidential Citizens Medal and numerous other honors. He is the author or editor of at least 12 books on foreign policy and international relations. In a world in disarray, Haass argues for an updated global operating system. He calls it World Order 2.0, that reflects the reality that power is widely distributed and that borders count for less. He also details how the United States should act toward China and Russia, as well as Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. And we'll talk with him about all of this and current affairs as it relates to the Trump administration. Richard Haass, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for hosting us here. Well, Richard Haass, before we discuss the themes of A World in Disarray, which is an apt title, I would say, let's talk about your reaction to the U.S. airstrikes on the Syrian airbase. This is President Trump's action, which to some extent contradicts his earlier statements with respect to Bashar al-Assad in Syria. What is your reaction to these strikes and what they portend?
Well, I supported the strikes. I think it's important that the United States demonstrate that use of any weapon of mass destruction, whether it's chemical, biological, or nuclear, is something that is simply intolerable. And this norm has weakened over recent years when 4 years ago the Syrians used chemical weapons and the United States didn't respond. So again, I thought this was the right thing to do. I don't see this as presaging or constituting a new phase of American involvement in the Syrian civil slash proxy slash regional slash global war. I think the administration will continue to be wary of getting seriously involved there. Instead, my guess is they will continue to focus on defeating ISIS, removing its territorial base, though obviously ISIS will live on in many other ways. And I think the real challenge will be in the short run for the administration in finding individuals and groups who can oversee, both in the security sense as well as politically, that territory which is liberated from ISIS and Raqqa. I think there's a much longer-term goal of finding a way to bring about a successor government to Bashar al-Assad. I don't see that on the near-term agenda. I think at best that is on the medium or long-term agenda.
Well, let's turn now to Russia. As Secretary of State Tillerson met with his counterpart this week in Moscow, Russia, of course, still denies that Bashar al-Assad was responsible for the chemical weapons attack. They are critical of U.S. action there. What does this do to President Trump's original thought that somehow Russia could be a partner, not only on the world stage in many respects, but particularly in Syria? At first, he thought that somehow Putin would be a partner in combating the Islamic State, but I think things have changed.
Well, the administration took office with a rather benign view or sanguine view of Russia and a rather optimistic view of what could be worked out between the United States and Russia. And I think it was overly optimistic given the pattern of Russian behavior, first in Ukraine, then in Syria, and then with the cyber interference in the American political process. And I think all of that adds up to Vladimir Putin and a Russia that is an outsider, something of a spoiler. All that said, and granted the Russian comments about the recent chemical use by the Syrian government, their reaction to the American strike, I don't think the idea of some type of eventual limited U.S.-Russian cooperation in Syria is inconceivable. I don't believe the Russians are interested in a long-term expensive intervention there. I think they had their fill of long-term expensive interventions in places like Afghanistan. I think their intervention in Syria has been quite inexpensive. They've had a very good return on a very limited investment. And if the prospect ever grows that the costs of what they do in Syria go up, I think Russian interest in some type of a political transition will go up. I also think Mr. Putin is many things. He is not sentimental. His commitment to Bashar al-Assad is secondary. I think Russia has interests in Syria. I think Russia has interests in showing itself to be a major power. So I would hope that once this immediate, difficult, or awkward period passes, the United States and Russia can begin a dialogue about some type, again, of political process that first would create some areas of Syria where it's safe for civilians to live. And then over time, to return to the question of a political transition, because so long as Bashar al-Assad is in power, it will continue to be a Syria where all sorts of terrorist groups operate. And that's not in Russia's interest either, because a lot of these terrorists are going to find their way back to Russia, and they're going to cause the kind of damage they caused recently in St. Petersburg.
But do you think there's any reason to believe that Vladimir Putin would abandon Bashar al-Assad? And do you think that President Trump can make Russia and Iran, let's not forget Iran is a major back, or pay a price for their support of Assad's depredations?
I believe Iran is a much more difficult diplomatic challenger. I don't see Iran in any way moving away from Syria, probably not from Assad. I think Russia's calculations are different. Again, I think Russia has long-term interests that are not tied to Mr. Assad. I think they're tied to perceptions of Russia's ability and willingness to act forcefully on behalf of its interests. I think it's tied to Russia's special interests in Syria. But if and when, and I think it's when Russia concludes that its support for Assad has a cost, whether it's in terms of Russian lives, the growth of terrorism, the long-term cost of what they're doing in Syria, I think Russia will begin to show greater interest in a political transition in which Mr. Assad is not in power. Whether it's at the middle or the end of that transition, I don't know. But at some point, I believe Russian and Mr. Assad's interests diverge.
But you don't think the United States can help to increase the cost?
Well, again, I think we can by supporting various groups in Syria. I think we should be supporting various Sunni groups that we believe we can work with that have goals that are at least not totally inconsistent with our own. And that will raise the cost to the regime and conceivably to the Russians itself. We should be willing to give air defense equipment to certain groups. If the Syrians are foolish enough to use chemical weapons again, they should pay an even larger price than they did. And so I think we can affect the calculations of probably not of Mr. Assad, who's prepared to fight for the finish, but maybe to some of the people around him. I don't think Alawite and Assad interests are exactly the same. And again, I think that Russia's interests potentially diverge both from Mr. Assad's as well as from Iran's. Iran is physically there. They have no choice. Geography can't be changed. Russia has more choices than does Iran.
Richard Haas, to what extent do you think the shadow of the Russia probe, you know, these investigations, whether the FBI or congressional investigations into possible links between Mr. Trump and his campaign officials and Moscow, who meddled in the U.S. election, affect the dynamics, perhaps, of these negotiations?
It's a good question. The honest answer is I don't know. The American rhetoric has been quite critical of Russia. So the idea that people are looking away from what Russia has done, I don't see it. I mean, the president hasn't spoken out a lot about Russia directly, but he's been quite critical of Syria. He has obviously made the decision to use military force against the Syrians, and he knew that would not sit well with the Russians. But since I don't know the background, if you will, none of us knows exactly what, if any, connections there are between this administration and Russia. We don't know the details of what Russia did, much less its effects. We may not know the answers to those questions for months or even years, if then. So I just take things as I see them. And the administration, I think, has been critical of Russia, but now I believe also needs to find a way to potentially work with Russia. I wouldn't assume that the United States and Russia are implacably opposed permanently in Syria.
I guess the question is, you know, in exchange for what and to what extent the United States has leverage, and many are worried about perhaps the United States ceding on sanctions vis-a-vis Ukraine. And
well, again, I think what Russia has done in Ukraine violates the most basic principle or norm of international relations, that borders ought not to be changed through the use of force. So I would argue that sanctions introduced because of Ukraine should only be lifted when Russian behavior vis-a-vis Ukraine, whether it's Crimea or more realistically in the near term in eastern Ukraine, that we see some changes there. We ought not to get tired, if you will, of our own sanctions. We ought to wait until Russian behavior changes.
Let's talk about the slow pace of this administration's filling of critical deputy positions in the State Department and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You were, of course, at policy planning at State. That's a vital nucleus for intelligence and strategic thinking for policymaking. How detrimental is it to our national interest that so many high-level people are not yet in place?
Well, the short answer is you can't sustain an administration, you can't sustain American foreign policy without having many of these people in place at the State Department, at the Pentagon, and at the White House. You don't have the benefit of all this expertise. And when it comes to executing or implementing American foreign policy, you need these seasoned professionals. So I think this has gone on way too long. Here we are, we're coming up on 3 months for this administration, getting close to the proverbial 100-day point. And I worry at the lack of progress. We haven't identified the people who need to come into these jobs. They haven't had their hearings in many cases. They certainly haven't been confirmed. So I would not be surprised if a lot of these senior people didn't get in till the summer or even late this year in the fall. And the world is not going to press the pause button while the United States gets its people in place. So this has got to be a priority, and I'm dismayed that it doesn't seem to be.
Why do you think it's taking so long?
That's in the realm of speculation, but obviously there's political differences either within the White House or between the White House and the departments about who ought to be considered for these jobs. A lot of the most natural pool of talent on the Republican side seems to have been precluded from being offered these jobs because they signed these letters critical of candidate Trump. And my own recommendation, and I've made this point publicly and privately, is these individuals ought to receive the equivalent of a pardon. That the president, if he wants to succeed, needs to be able to call upon the best and the brightest, the most talented Americans. My own view is a lot of these people oppose Donald Trump becoming president, but you only have one president at a time, and he's the president of the United States. Every American should hope that he succeeds. So I, again, would hope that the administration would get over its unhappiness with what people said and wrote during the campaign and would simply be willing to hire the most talented people out there.
There's one more challenge, Richard Haass, and that is with the people who are in their positions as mm-hmm. we speak, and I'm referring to rivalries within sure. the White House. You have Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, a very young fellow with not a lot of experience, given a great deal of responsibility. Then you have Steve Bannon. Okay, he was removed from the Principals Committee, but nonetheless, he is a campaign and political strategist. He is still in the White House. And then you have the likes of Defense Secretary Mattis, you have H.R. McMaster, the new director of the National Security Council. So the question is, who prevails in this situation?
Well, you've got several issues packed into that. One is you've got multiple centers of authority, and that can be complicating for a president. It's good the president gets a wide range of advice, but there's got to be a centralized channel so all these things come together. There's got to be a decision-making mechanism to resolve the differences, and then there's got to be tight oversight of implementation. And I worry that with all these centers of decision-making at the White House and scattered around the administration, is you could have issues that get revisited and then revisited again, that the implementation is not sufficiently disciplined. So I think I would like to see a more traditional set of arrangements in terms of who prevails, what sort of thinking. At the end of the day, there's only one person who has a vote, and that's called the President of the United States. So Donald Trump will prevail. The question is, what will be the basis of his decisions? How consistent will he be? He comes into the office with strong views, but not any background in governing, not a lot of background in foreign policy. So the first 60 or 90 days, he's been quite inconsistent. And I think that is, again, it's reflective of his own background, and I think it's reflective of the sort of loose set of mechanisms and the diverse range of people he's put into office.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Igwe Osaji. He's from Benin City, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, let's get to your book, Richard Haass, A World in Disarray. Talk about what you mean by a world in disarray. Why is it in disarray? What are the factors that have led to this state?
Well, the world's in disarray. I think if any listener would simply take a step back for a moment, the Middle East is in turmoil. Disarray is an understatement. Look at the number of failed states, civil wars, regional wars, you name it. Europe has gone from the most stable, predictable part of the world to anything but. You've had the Russian invasion of Crimea. You've had Brexit. We now have the uncertainty of the French elections, the Greek economy, the refugee crisis, the rise of populists and nationalists. The entire future of the European Union is suddenly in doubt. Asia, you've got the rise of China. You've got the North Korean nuclear and missile threat. You've got challenges in Latin America, say in Venezuela, South Sudan, or the DRC in Africa. And then globally, you have all sorts of areas where there's global challenges, say like cyber, the internet, and there's very few rules. So I think the disarray is obvious. How did we get here? In part, it's because of globalization and all these phenomena which move across borders and with great speed and great amounts in ways that the world can't handle. I think the end of the Cold War added to the disarray because you went from two centers of decision-making, highly disciplined and controlled, to a world now of hundreds of decision-makers, and capacity now is in more hands than ever before. I think the United States has contributed to the disarray at times by what we've done, the Iraq War, one could argue, more recently leaving the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or things we haven't done. 4 years ago in Syria, not acting when Syria crossed the red line, or not following up the Libya intervention with any sort of force. And I think the Trump administration has added to all this by introducing a much greater degree of uncertainty as to whether the United States is going to basically be recognizable in the world or whether it's going to embrace some significant departures. So for all these reasons, this is at least a world of disarray.
And of course, you talk about how you think the United States should approach this world in disarray. You talk about something called sovereign obligation, World Order 2.0. Talk about what you mean by that term, and why would it be a desirable compass for U.S. foreign policy?
Each era of history has its own defining challenges. Much of history is about the rise of great powers who decide that they're going to threaten all their neighbors, World War I, World War II, the Cold War. This is something very different. There's no great power who's threatening the security and stability of the world, but we do have a massive set of problems at the global level where we have everything from terrorists to computer hackers, to climate change, to disease outbreaks, to a breakdown of the global trading system. You have all these challenges, and there's a tremendous gap between the willingness and ability of the world on one hand to come together to deal with these challenges and the threats that they pose. And my argument is simply that we need to maintain the idea of sovereignty, a world of sovereign states, a world where you can't use force to change borders. But that's not enough. It's not enough to simply say everything that goes on inside your territory is your business alone. Because what we've learned is that in a global world, very few things stay local. If there's a disease outbreak, if there's a terrorist, if there's a hacker, if you have coal-burning electricity plants, all of those things will have consequences for others. So my argument is, if the 21st century is not going to be a disaster, it's not going to be a world of chaos or a world of anarchy, we have got to set up a set of arrangements that we, the world, the United States, working with others, in some cases not just with other states, it might be with companies, it might be with NGOs, that we work on what is it that states and governments have to do to regulate or control or get on top of things within their own territory that could have a negative consequence for others. And we will either do that and we will shape the 21st century in some good ways, or we will fail to do that, and this will be a century defined by terrorism and proliferation and climate change and worse. So that's the challenge, and what I argue for is American foreign policy needs to adjust to take that into account.
Do you think that President Donald Trump, who has talked about so-called America First, a much more inward-looking, approach to America's role in the world, anti-globalist stance, are you confident that he could pivot into this direction? And what if he does not?
It's a good question and a fair question. And the honest answer is I'm not confident. He may do it in some areas. He probably won't in others. So where he is unwilling to, it might be that other countries have to step up. It could be the Europeans. It could be China in some areas. It could be other groups that could be helpful. Certain things may have to wait for Donald Trump's successor. I understand that. Look, this was not going to be the work of one administration. This was going to be the work of decades. I think the sooner we get started, the better. We've already seen the price we pay for unregulated cyberspace. We've seen, we're losing the battle against climate change. So time is not on our side here. But if the Trump administration is unwilling to play a large role, the rest of the world can do some things without the United States, can maybe pressure the United States to join. But many things won't get done, and I think the United States will pay a price, and others will pay a price for it as well. But sooner or later, I am predicting the world will come around to this, because I don't think this is idealism. I think this is very pragmatic realism for a very different kind of world.
What do you make of the new Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson? He's been criticized for avoiding the limelight and starkly reducing media access. Do you think he's the chief U.S. diplomat in more than name only?
Well, again, he's been in the job for only a couple of months. He doesn't have a foreign policy background. He has great experience, though, working in the world. So I think people ought to give him a little bit of time. He's beginning to do more with the press on this most recent trip. He's got to deal, though, with the reality of a president who likes to tweet. And he's got to deal with the reality that there's several people at the White House who also have a role in foreign policy. So I think it's too soon to be offering judgments or pronouncements. But I think it's a difficult task, one made more difficult by the fact he doesn't have a staff in place. If I were Rex Tillerson, I would be focusing on cementing my relationship with the president, working on bringing about an interagency process that is disciplined, and putting into place a talented pool of people that I could depend on.
For a world order 2.0, I think we would have to have resources, both financial and political, in order to execute that. So in that light, what about the proposed budget cuts that Mr. Trump has offered? And even if all of them aren't going to be accepted by Congress, just the fact that theoretically he would like to reduce the State Department budget, the Environmental Protection Agency, and many other budgets.
Yeah, I don't agree with most of those cuts. I think they're short-sighted. I think the United States needs to have a full range of tools or instruments, including the military, but also intelligence, including foreign aid. We need to also do things for our own society. So I would see national security in much broader terms, and I would be funding it much more. The good news, by the way, is we can afford to. If you add up everything we're spending on defense and all other aspects of national security, it's a fraction of the level of our GDP that we spent during the Cold War. So we can have, if you will, the guns we need as well as the butter we need. But I think when it comes to maintaining and projecting American influence around the world, we can't be one-dimensional. It can't just be military. We've got to do things diplomatically. We've got to do things using aid, using trade. We've got to prevent disease outbreaks. We've got to build capacity around the world. So we need many other national security tools other than the military instrument. And interestingly enough, most people in uniform agree with me. Usually the biggest backers of the United States maintaining the full range of national security instruments happen to be people wearing a uniform, because they understand the need for these other tools. And also, they don't want the military tool. They don't want soldiers and airmen and sailors to be overwhelmed.
Well, in that light, do you think that President Trump can actually learn on the job? I mean, he's talked about America first, using that mantra. One could also interpret it, okay, America first, but if America acts in its self-interest, acting in its self-interest intrinsically means having a rather dominant role in the world stage, but we don't know whether he would see it that way.
I've worked for four presidents. I worked for President Carter, President Reagan, and both Presidents Bush. Every president learns on the job. No president emerges the same after his first crisis. The Oval Office is an intense, nonstop education. So President Trump will learn on the job. My guess is he's already different than the person who walked into the Oval Office nearly 3 months ago. Now, exactly what he'll learn, what lessons he will draw, I don't know. But you know, the potential is there for change. I think outsiders are probably a little bit too quick to discuss or describe the change with great confidence. But already I see some signs of evolution. And again, certain initial policy pronouncements he's walked away from. So in the course of a few months, we've gone from a one China policy to a two China policy, back to a one China policy. Our policy on Mexico seems to be evolving. Russia, we've moved from a cozy direction to something decidedly less cozy. You had the use of force recently in Syria. You see the selection in some ways of North Korea as the principal national security challenge facing the United States. One could go on and on. So already there's been some real evidence of learning.
What about the travel ban, though? We still have the travel ban. It's, of course, in great dispute in the courts. But President Trump would like to restrict immigration and ban people from certain countries.
Again, it's an area I disagree with. I think the United States has in place a lot of the vetting it needs. I don't think singling out certain countries make sense. I don't think banning or limiting so severely refugees make sense. I worry about, among other things, that this will alienate the 3 million or so Muslim Americans in that entire community. I'm much more worried about people being inspired and radicalized by policies or by what they read and see over the internet than I am about people slipping through our controls at the border. So I think this is, on balance, counterproductive and will not make America more safe. The courts have pushed back. We'll see how that plays out. I think it's a reminder also in the American political system that you have decentralized authority, and whether it's the media, the courts, the Congress, we saw that on healthcare. What the president, I think, is also doing, he's getting something of an education in American civics. And the president is first among equals, but he's just that. He's first. There's others who have political authority, who have influence. And I think that, again, that'll be part of the learning process here.
In a 2.0 world, what do you think the role of free trade should be? Because another area where Mr. Trump is in great disagreement is on that very topic. He's very anti-free trade, and it sort of goes against the grain in terms of where we're headed as a world.
Look, when I look at the history of the world over the last 50, 75 years, I believe trade has been a great engine for good. It's created far more jobs than it's lost. It's been an anchor for development. It's strengthened our allies. It's also given would-be adversaries reasons to act with restraint. So I think trade has been a good thing, and I think it's unfortunate that the administration took the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'm hoping they will come to terms with NAFTA. NAFTA needs to be modernized and adapted, but not more than that. I hope the administration revisits our policy towards an Asia-Pacific trading arrangement. Look, the real source of job disappearance is not trade. It's not immigration. The real source of job disappearance in the United States and elsewhere is modernity. It is technological innovation. In the future, it's going to be autonomous or driverless vehicles. It's going to be machine learning and artificial intelligence. It's going to be robotics. So we can close our borders to people. We can close our borders to goods. But that's not going to bring these jobs back. We have got to think about the training, the education, and so forth to help Americans get ready for the reality that certain jobs are going to disappear and other jobs are going to be introduced. And I'm hoping the administration comes around to seeing that. There's a lot of statistics to support what I'm saying. And again, I hope we invest in our people rather than support policies that essentially close our borders. That's a false answer.
Are there any upsides to what we've seen so far, unpredictable policies by President Trump, whether diplomatic, economic, or political?
Well, there's a school of thought in this field that unpredictability has an upside. It can make actual or would-be foes a little bit more careful, a little bit more restrained, simply because they don't know what awaits them if they act in certain ways. It can make allies, perhaps in some situations, prepared to do a little bit more to win over somebody. On balance, though, I'm not a big fan of unpredictability. I think it's important that allies know exactly what awaits them if they cross certain lines. I think friends and allies who place their security in our hands need to be 100% confident that we're there for them. I don't want them to start hedging or taking out insurance policies. I don't want them deferring to powerful neighbors. I don't want them taking matters into their own hands. So if I had to choose, I much prefer an American foreign policy based upon predictability, reliability. We ought to be more the preservers of things rather than the disruptors. We've been very well served by this world in Europe, in Asia more broadly. I don't think the United States, all things being equal, is well served by a foreign policy of disruption. I mean, don't get me wrong. We don't have everything answered. We can't just be a status quo power. I get that. But right now, there are real challenges in Europe, from Russia, from the rise of populism. You got a North Korea in Asia. The Middle East is unraveling. You've got the global challenges we talked about. The United States shouldn't be adding to the mix. Mr. Trump's inherited an extraordinarily demanding inbox. I would think that his goal ought to be to reduce what's coming into his inbox rather than adding to it.
The book is A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order. The author, Richard Haass, President of the Council on Foreign Relations. Richard Haass, thank you so much for your wonderful insights.
Thanks, Carol.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.